Hello and welcome once again to Android Developer Office Hours. My name is Joe Mallon. I'm your moderator. To my right is Trevor Johns. Beyond him is Jeff Sharkey and Radel Meyer. And
hey,
at the producers panel is Robert Lee. And I can't think of anything else to say at this moment except that our topic for today is performance.
More importantly, it's efficiency.
And efficiency, sorry. Efficiency. I'll get that right eventually. So we've got a video. Thank you very much. Shout out your questions. You can get into the Hangout and call them in, or you can type them in, or whatever you want to do. For the moment, since we don't have any of those from the Hangout, we're going to go to moderator and take some of the questions that have been entered already. The first question is there a simple way to get distinct results from the contacts provider? I use the loader manager to create a cursor loader. Cursor is passed to an adapter of an autocomplete text field, but I get dupes. I will try to answer this, and if the person that asked this is online, I would like to know more about exactly what you're trying to do. My guess is, based on what you've said, you're getting duplicates because there are distinct records in the provider for the same person. And that's the way the provider is supposed to work. You will not... The provider is set up so that different versions of the same person from different sources are recorded as distinct records. Yeah. And they're not... The duplicates are not eliminated. What happens is they're aggregated into a single record that points to all of these different versions.
Yeah. So, for example, you could have your the contact from Google, from your Google contact book, as well as the data that's retrieved from Google Plus that the user themselves entered.
Right. So, depending on how you access the provider, you could get a person's record based on their personal Gmail, their work Gmail, Google Plus, etc. And the documentation for contacts provider that's on developer.android.com explains to you how to deal with that situation and get the sort of data that you may be looking for. And that's probably why you're getting duplicates. If you were to look at all the information in the records that are being returned to you, you'd see that some of it was different.
Yeah, so I guess as a tip, stay away from the raw contacts table. Also, the data table is going to have duplicate data as well, but I believe the high-level contacts table should have a single representation of of each person,
right.
And that would be a good starting point if you're trying to read through the docs.
There's, if you look in the documentation, you'll see some examples of how to retrieve different types of information from the provider, and also look at the things called entities. What entities do is do a sort of behind-the-scenes combine of different pieces of data that help you do the sorts of things that you might want to do with a provider. But I definitely suggest you look at the documentation. Anything else?
No, I think that pretty much covered it.
Okay. Next question. What are some tips for file manager UIs? I'm currently writing an app that, although it autosaves its saved files, an external one should be accessible for edit to the user. The file browsers on the store are in lists or icons. DPI is also a factor.
All right. So first thing, don't show the raw file system is my recommendation, right? There's a number of file manager apps out there, for example, Astro. And they're good tools for power users, but it's not the model we want for Android UIs. We really want to say, okay, here's the documents on your device. We don't really care where they live. Are they on internal storage, external storage, in some subfolder? All that's irrelevant. We don't actually want to expose the underlying you know, Linux file system. We just want to say, again, here's all the docs we could find. Go ahead and pick one and open it up. If you're asking whether I should be a list versus thumbnails versus some sort of icon, I tend to lean a little bit more towards the idea of either a list or thumbnails, and possibly even allow the user to pick. If you have more screen real estate, thumbnails are really nice, but they do take up more space. A good example, if you're looking at something to model off of, would be Google Docs. They do a really, or Google Drive, excuse me. They do a really awesome list view for displaying files. And because they don't have a file hierarchy or a folder hierarchy by default, they have to go and do that really well. Of course, you still can create folders, and they handle that too. But I guess that's my advice. It's really more of a UI question, and without seeing your app, I don't think we can give you one-size-fits-all recommendations here. But I think that should be some good general guidance.
Any other comments?
Yeah, one thing to think about when you're building a file browser like that, you're going to have the different UI on phones versus tablets. So on a phone, you might end up with that single list view where the user navigates deeper into a file hierarchy. You might be able to present the tree or the file system tree on like a left-hand side pane using something like Fragments on a tablet-sized app. So it definitely depends on which size of device you're targeting. You might be able to fit more or less details.
Yeah, I think generally, you know, I just want to reiterate what Trevor and Joe have already said, and that is, generally speaking, you know, the move has been away from having sort of hierarchical file structures to support your app. I mean, it kind of made sense back in sort of the pre-GUI days where you had to figure out a way to be able to put things in a place you'd be able to find them again if all you've got is the ability to list the files in a folder and what the current folder is. These days, the move is very much away from that. It's really more about tagging things, making them more easily searchable. And you can see the way that Google Drive does that, in that your things just sort of sit there, and you can tag them, and you can search for them. And the same with Gmail, which was sort of the forerunner for that. So in most cases, if what you're building is just a file manager, then you know, I think it does have some value if you're figuring out how to put a file manager into your app to make it easier for users to save files and load files. I'd say that you're probably going in slightly the wrong direction. You should be thinking more about how can you make it easy for people to find the content that they're looking for without having to navigate a hierarchy in order to do so.
Okay. Yeah, I would add that the difference is that if you use some sort of file hierarchy like old-fashioned directories, then you're kind of stuck with putting one thing in one place, whereas if you tag it or give it some metadata that you can then search on it for, you can put something, so to speak, in more than one place at the same time, kind of like the way that labels work in Gmail. I mean, they appear sometimes to be folders, but they're really not. A message can be in more than one label. It can have more than one label at the same time, and that's a great benefit to users.
Yep. And yeah, another thing to think about, too, we're just beating file archives to death here, but when you have nested folders or nested directories, you have to go and click through all of them. And that's sort of a pain on a mobile device. It's a lot easier if you have a list. You swipe, you tap, you're done. And again, Radio touched on this. Search is incredibly important to make sure you have that in there. I'd say it's more important than tagging. If you can only implement one of these suggestions, it would be search.
Okay.
We got a question on a Hangout here.
Okay.
How do I go about creating a category side view, which takes only half the screen when sufficient real estate is available, with a pager title strip, similar to what is shown in Google Play?
Okay, so the question was, can people hear you on the Hangout?
Yes.
Okay, fine. So you've heard the question.
I heard the question, but could you repeat it, actually?
Sure thing. How do I go about creating a category side view which takes only half the screen when sufficient real estate is available, with a pager title strip similar to what is shown in Google Play?
Also, yeah, I know that in Google Play you can swipe. I'm not sure what the side view is, though. We're trying to pull it up here so we have an example.
So you go up to the top level, go into one of the categories.
Oh, category? Okay,
yeah,
so you're going to go into
pull
apps.
Left, yeah. I think it'll even work in Portrait as well.
And pool.
Or in one of the apps, so like apps or magazines.
Yeah, we need to hook up our HDMI tablet here so we can actually show you this.
Okay, so let me just
demonstrate.
Turn it around.
Yeah, hold it up to the camera.
On screen. Get rid of the glare. And when I pull, and it stops halfway across, and I can pull it back. And it's exactly at halfway. So that's, I presume that that's the functionality that they are looking for. Excellent, getting head nods. All right, that's a good question. How would you do that? So I would guess that this isn't using a ViewPager.
Oh, or at least it's a modified version of ViewPager.
Mm.
To my knowledge, there's no way by default to ask ViewPager to do that for you. There's another question a little bit further down on the question queue too, which touches on this, which is asking, for example, Google Plus. When you tap the home button, you have a navigation panel that slides out from the left. And right now, there's nothing in the support library or otherwise elsewhere in the framework that really makes this easy to do. And our recommendation actually right now is really, it's an awesome model. I love it. But it's not something we're actually actively recommending to people because there's been so much flux with these widgets. Everybody's done it a little bit differently, so there's not really a single recommended approach as far as our UI guidelines are concerned. So if you really do want to implement it right now, you're sort of on your own. Over time, once we actually figure out what the right way this should look should be, we'll add it somewhere, support library most likely, but that's a ways off, and that's assuming that we actually decide we like it, right? It's always possible we'll change our minds later on. So, pretty much you're on your own, unfortunately, and there's really, and from the technical perspective, if you want a good place to start, I'd start with ViewPager and start modifying that, but it's not going to be as simple as just setting a property.
So it looks, so if we try and think it through, so it looks like what it's doing is because all of the other interaction works exactly the same as ViewPager. So if you started with that, and it looks like all it's doing is saying if you're at n plus 1, well, I guess at 1, then you're going to limit the size of the fragment for the 0th fragment, right? So that would seem to be a place to start. So have a look at the ViewPager, and what you want to do is modify the behavior if the first fragment is visible. So that it doesn't fully extend to the full width of the screen. Yeah. I don't think we have any sample code, so... Yeah.
Nope, I'm not aware of any either. Yeah.
The person in the Hangout says they looked into that using a view flipper in combination with animations, but they could not figure out how to limit the size. Never mind, not the view flipper. Radio suggestion. They tried what I suggested
with the ViewPager and couldn't find out how to limit the size. Yeah, I think that's going to be the struggle because the way that the ViewPager is designed is to effectively just do the animations between two set frames. And so sort of having those two fragments on screen. I mean, the other possibility that you may want to try is to have the 0th fragment contain... So that what you're actually looking at on that view pager isn't actually the last fragment being half width. It's just that the last fragment looks like the previous fragment and the first fragment joined together, if that makes sense. So I don't know how you would do the animation, but maybe once you get halfway across and then it switches it. I don't know. It's getting a little bit hairy, even in my own mind. But we'd be interested to see how you get on, but I don't think that there's an easy solution for that at this point, unfortunately. And like Trevor says, the best chance in terms of getting something relatively straightforward is to wait and see if we or anyone else creates a standardized widget that does something similar to what GPLOS and YouTube did.
Okay,
we got another question on the Hangout.
All right.
I am looking for tools or methods that will help me test my app in extreme conditions. For example, low memory, low disk space, high CPU usage, and in parentheses, that is done by another process.
Okay.
Right. At first, I thought here extreme conditions. Like, are you going to go and try and drop it in a volcano, launch it into space, take it over to Antarctica? Space has been done, by the way. We actually have launched Android phones into space, but I'm not aware of any that have gone into volcanoes. But seriously, though,
challenge accepted.
Anybody know a good volcano nearby? So.
Sounds like an excuse to go to Hawaii to me.
Yeah, so some of the things, like slow network in particular, there's support for in the emulator. Now, low disk space, I'm not aware of any really good automated ways to go and test that other than writing a script that goes and dumps a bunch of files onto your SD card. I know there are some third-party companies that make some test suites that do go and test some things, like, you know, what happens when the battery gets low. So off the top of my head, I believe Testroid is one of the ones that can do some of this stuff. I don't think it can do everything on your list, but it's worth looking into. That's by a company called Bitbar. And so they offer a subscription service where you upload your APK to their servers and they run a series of tests on devices you've supplied to them. Or sorry, on devices they've supplied for you. Yeah, you don't have to mail them any devices. And that's probably your best bet if you're looking to try and do a lot of this, short of trying to go and automate a bunch of it yourself using things like ADB to go and... actually, ADB only gets you so far, even. Like, if you're trying to test low battery, you'd have to hook up some hardware and you know, start modifying the voltage. That's a tough one. So, really no easy way there, other than what the emulator already provides. And it does supply some of it, so definitely look at that first.
One other tool that can potentially be really powerful is the Monkey, which generates a bunch of random events, so touches on the screen, keyboard event inputs, and it'll push your app in all different directions. And we use that a lot on the team to help uncover bugs in all of our apps across the platform. So it'll generate a lot of that noise. It'll uncover race conditions a lot of times in code. So the Monkey tool is great. You can find that it's just using ADB on the command line.
Yeah, similarly, I think that, you know, if you're trying to simulate these sort of extreme conditions based on what other apps are doing, the easiest solution for in a lot of cases is going to be to create your own version of those other apps. And the extreme conditions are going to be when other apps are misbehaving. So you get to have fun and create an app which is really poorly behaved. It does everything that we tell you not to do, which chews up memory and causes other apps to effectively swap out and get killed.
I think we actually... was it Dan Hackborn wrote actually something very similar to that for our own internal use for a while. our own builds had a very badly misbehaving app installed on them for a bit to go and try and test what happens when apps misbehave. Thankfully, that doesn't ship. But I think that's probably a good approach, is, you know, just write a really bad app, and that's, you know, going to go and cover, at least from the performance side of things, what happens when things go wrong.
That's usually the easiest way to do it. You can do a lot through simulating things, but ultimately it's going to be, you know, how does my app behave when another app is using all my bandwidth, using all my processor, using all my storage, is to build that other app. And it gives you the control as well, because then you can decide how far you want it to go. So at what point does my app start being unresponsive, and what steps should I take to try and help the system out?
Any other comments? No? Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. Let's move on. I think I skipped one here. I have a fragment which uses a loader. It implements the loader callbacks. I have set retain instance true for the fragment so that it is not destroyed across orientation changes. However, the loader it creates and the onCreate loader gets reset. Why?
That's a good question. I've never seen this behavior before, so I'm not sure what the answer is off the top of my head. This also, I think, was a later question to come into the queue, so I didn't get a chance to research it beforehand. I actually do not know the answer to this.
No?
Don't know.
Okay.
Yeah. That seems strange.
Well, the panel is puzzled.
Our usual advice, if you can go ahead and post a question on Stack Overflow, we try and take a look at anything that we can't answer after the show and get an answer for you. So just go ahead and drop a comment on the G+ post pointing to a Stack Overflow question, and we'll try and get some more detail for you after the show.
Yeah, the other thing which I'd want to mention for this one in particular, set retain instance state on fragments is awesome, but generally it's designed to work specifically for fragments which don't have a UI. Which is a perfectly good place to put a loader. So one of the things that I'd mention as a word of caution is that if you are using that on a fragment with UI, that may be causing the problem. So I need to look into more detail, because this is something just vaguely tingling in the back of my mind. But generally speaking, the set retain instance state property is designed for UI-less fragments.
Got another question on the Hangout?
All right.
I have a performance question related to databases. What are the overhead implications with SQLite and increasing the number of tables?
That's a good question. I'd say adding more tables probably is not going to hurt you too much. What is going to hurt you is joins, and at some point just having so many records that it takes a while to iterate through all of them. Setting indexes wisely is definitely going to help. Indexes do increase the cost when you perform a write, and it's a trade-off. In exchange, you get faster read times. I'd say, yeah, that's pretty much where you're going to see most of your performance, is trying to do joins and trying to iterate through a lot of records, or searching on fields that don't have an index, that sort of thing. Adding more tables should be fine. So, performance impact, minimal.
Any other comments? All right, let's move on. In the past, I've used an intent service to load data from a REST web service, but I saw that in the new Google I/O app that async loaders are used extensively. Is loader currently the recommended way to load remote data? When should intent service be used?
Okay, so I think this one's a bit of confusion about the way the Google I/O app works. So using an async loader to go and pull data from a web service doesn't actually sound like a very good idea to me. And we actually don't do that in the Google I/O app. What we do is we have a background service in conjunction with a sync adapter, which goes and fetches the data from the web service, stores it in a local database, and then that loader is used to go and fetch the data out of the local database. And that's the model we're using. It's nice because we don't have to worry about trying to fetch data while the app's running. Everything's already cached locally. And in the background, we actually can send a GCM message to the phone, informing it that the schedule's changed, and then it can go and update the conference schedule in the background. So that way, every time you open the app, you don't have to wait for a couple minutes while it fetches the latest schedule data. You know you always have the latest data right on your phone that are already cached. So as far as the other half of the question, which is when should intent service be used? And I think in that case, partly it's a matter of convenience. What's easier for you? Intent service is still going to run as a service. We're still running as a service. It's just, intent service is more, if I remember correctly, because I've actually never used that one myself, but I think that's more for one-off jobs. You specify a bunch of you specify your request inside of an intent. Whereas in this case, since we're always going and doing the same thing over and over again, we're always fetching these schedule changes. There's really, I think it works better as just a self-contained background service. Rado, did you have any comments on when intent service is a better choice?
Yeah, actually, me and Joe have actually been talking about this a little bit over the last couple of weeks. I think if you're looking specifically between intent service and async task, I think that's generally the sort of question people have, is often you'll come across the async task class first and see it as a really convenient way of being able to do background stuff, which you want to get off the UI thread to work in Android. And it's great. And it does all of the marshalling to the UI thread for you, which is really, really handy. But that's kind of a clue as to when it's most appropriate as well. So there is some overhead associated with it. And what it's really designed for is doing something within your activity which is going to have a direct impact on your UI. So if it's something which is allowed to get destroyed as soon as your activity gets closed, because remember, of course, that your async tasks within an activity, as soon as you rotate the device, they're all going to get killed. So it's really stuff which should not be long-lived. It's just too time-consuming to do on the UI thread. Intent service is just a really neat way of being able to encapsulate one of the most common service implementation patterns. So a service is basically designed there for anything within your app which needs to live longer than the average lifespan of a particular activity instance. So anything which needs to live across multiple activities, anything which should stay, continue to be active when you're rotating the screen, all that sort of stuff should live in a service. So anything which you're downloading, which is more than, anything non-trivial which you're downloading, probably wants to be in a service. And the intent service is really handy because it creates this queue for you. So it'll just basically create a serial queue where you keep sending it commands to do, and it will just keep going through them until all the tasks have been done, and then neatly kill the service for you. So if you're doing things like intermittent download, so as Trevor says, anything which is going to be on a regular schedule, anything which has to happen, on an ongoing basis, should probably live, use something like a sync adapter. But if you're just going to be downloading things when a user clicks something, so you don't really know when it's going to happen, then intent service is perfect, because you just send it the thing, say, "Ooh, I want you to download this." it will download it. When it's finished, it updates your content provider, and then your UI automatically gets updated via its loader when the content provider associated with it has been updated. So it just helps to create that nice sort of pattern for you. And often that's kind of the way it works as well. It's like you intuitively, like you when you first get started with something, you have an activity, you have your UI. So there's a temptation to just do everything within that class. And that's kind of the trick behind Android, is that your sort of main form is actually made up of your activity plus the services that support it plus potentially a content provider as well. So you really need to think of all of those modules and how they fit together in order to create something that works in the best way.
Thank you. Good answer.
Thank you. I need to take a beverage to moisten my mouth after I talk.
Any other comments?
So the one other value of intent service is really if you're in your UI and you want to persist something, if you really want to make sure that it gets saved, that's what intent service is there for. Because even if the user hits the home key or gets an incoming phone call, if you've kicked that off in an async task, there's the potential that your process gets killed and that data may not be saved. So if the data is important, send it off to that intent service.
Right.
If it's something that's important to persist.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I would add that it's really great for being able to go send off some work to be done, allowing the user then to go off and do any other task that may come up, so that if a phone call comes in or the user wants to go off and do some work and wait for this thing to finish, they can go do that and then get a notification or some other indication when the work is done and then go back to the activity. Okay, let's move
along.
We've
got another live question.
Shoot.
Is there a way to use a different class loader at development time, not necessary for production, for services? It looks like it's possible to do this for activities using instrumentation's new activity method, but I'd like to do this for all parts of an app.
A different class loader, okay. The only thing that instrumentation does really in terms of loading classes is that it allows you a little bit of extra control or injection into activities. And there's instrumentation available for services and for content providers as well as for activities. That's the only answer that I can give myself. So I'd be curious to see what the use case is to know what the answer would be.
Yeah, I mean, I know it definitely is possible to specify a different class loader within your activity. When you start going and firing off other things like creating a new service, creating other activities, I think you have limited control there. But I know there definitely is a way to go and control things once your activity has gotten started. So, unfortunately, it's not a very common task, so I can't remember the way to do it off the top of my head, but I know it definitely can be done. For example, I know there was some talk a while back of trying to use this as an obfuscation mechanism and encrypt classes and do all sorts of other fun things like that. Again, not something I'd usually recommend most developers try and concern themselves with, because lots of pitfalls lie down that road. But definitely is possible.
So he basically says, I want to load the activity itself with another class loader.
Right, yeah, well, that's the question. Oh, the activity itself, I don't think that's possible. I think at the best you can do is load classes within the activity, because activity startup is not something that you can control, right? By the time you have control, your activity has already been loaded.
Could you do something within the application object if you created your own application?
Well, you get a chance? Will any of that run before your activity is actually created?
Yeah, application will.
I mean, it will get it maybe slightly before.
The application instance will get created before the activity.
Maybe. It's worth a try, but I don't think any of us have ever attempted to do that.
Doesn't seem like a very good idea.
No, it's like I said, lots of dangers when you start messing with the class loader. It's usually something I recommend people stay away from. Also, yeah. It's a little odd. We've been getting a lot of questions today that are text only. You guys are welcome to go and hop on video chat or audio. Just let Robert, our producer, know, and he'll make sure that you get patched in live to us and we can actually talk to you face-to-face. But we are more than happy to answer text questions, too, if you don't have a camera.
Okay. We'll move along to the next question, moderator. How to create the drop-down slide-in navigation from action home up button. is it as convoluted as all my Google results indicate, or is there a simple way to do it? Google Plus, YouTube, and Spotify incorporate this feature.
So I think we already answered this one earlier, but just to reiterate, yes, it is as convoluted as all your Google results indicate. And on that note, also, we don't recommend really pursuing this until we have a recommendation as part of our design guide, or at the very least, the people start coming up with some libraries to do it. There's really nothing out there that makes it easy yet. That said, if you'd actually like to go and write, write the first library to implement this, I'm sure there's lots of developers that would thank you. But right now, it's not something we can really recommend people do unless they're really adventurous.
Yeah, I'd also point out as well, if anyone does decide to take Trevor up on that challenge, that so far the consensus, so each of these different implementations you mentioned are slightly different in the way that they work. Mm-hmm. And that's part of what Trevor's talking about, is that there isn't a real consensus based on the style guide as to the right way. That said, the consensus seems to be heading towards the YouTube model being sort of the right way of doing that. So if you do want to implement something similar, look at the way the YouTube app has implemented it and head in that direction. But for now, it's definitely not for beginners. I think it's going to be a little bit tricky to do.
Okay.
We have a live video question.
Go for it.
Yay.
Fire away.
Give me a minute here.
Are you on time?
Layout where we have an ad with a button next to it to like launch an in-app purchase, but every time we don't give the ad view the full width of the layout, it freaks out and says that it can't display the ad. But even if we create a VM that has a really tiny screen that is equivalent to what space it has, it will display the ad as long as we give it, like match parent or fill parent. And so we're trying to figure out how we can solve this. Right now, what we were thinking about is making a fragment that it was allowed to take the full width of, but I'd like to not complicate the layouts too much if possible.
Okay, so repeat this. Yeah. To repeat this, you've got an ad that you want to display with a button next to it to do something like in-app purchasing.
Correct.
Okay. And every time you try to set that up, it complains because it says you don't have enough room to display the ad.
Correct.
Interesting. So the ads are coming from a third-party provider like AdMob or something like that?
Yes. AdMob, to be specific.
Okay. Interesting. So this is only going to be an issue on certain size displays, right? So if it's say a phone where the AdMob banner is specified to be the right size to fit basically the full width of the phone, then you're going to have that issue when you try and put something next to it. Is that right?
Yeah, except for if we create a virtual machine that has a width in pixels of what the view would be expanded into. As long as we don't put the button there, it works fine. So we know that amount of real estate is sufficient to display the ad.
Gotcha. That's interesting. While we think about that, one thing which I would mention is that you need to be really careful when you're trying to create something like what you're describing. So one of the requirements we have in, I think it's our developer content policy, is that you shouldn't be putting ads anywhere where a user may accidentally click them. So putting ads right next to a button which you want people to press for any reason may actually be in violation of that, because it would be very easy to get confused and accidentally hit the ad instead of the button. Or
so then how does Pandora get away with it, because I hit those ads all the time?
fair call. I can't remember. I mean, I can have a look how the Pandora app works. Like I said, I'm not...
Actually display the ads behind the interface buttons.
That doesn't sound awesome. Yeah, so I can't comment on other apps and what they may or may not be doing wrong.
Right.
It's just something which has come up at least once before with a developer I was working with who ran into some problems on that basis. So I'd be cautious. You basically want to have any of your interactive elements as far away from your ads as possible to avoid running into those kinds of issues.
Okay, because I see Keys mentioned something about not being allowed to place ads or buttons close to the ad. So is that possibly the API is seeing that and causing a problem, or
that's actually possible. I hadn't considered that, but it is possible that the actual AdMob API is looking and seeing, oh, you've got a button right next to the ad that's, you know, not kosher. So yeah, it does seem a little strange. I'd be a little bit surprised if it was smart enough to do that on your behalf. But just from a UX perspective, if nothing else, I think it's really not best practice to have your interactive elements as that close to your banner ads.
Right. Okay. So regarding an in-app purchase button, then would that be something like in the overflow of the action bar that would be recommended?
Well, it depends on what you're buying, right? Yeah. It depends on the nature of the in-app purchase.
Well, it's like the premium kind of model.
Okay. So basically, it's an upgrade for your app that adds additional fee. All right. So yeah, the overflow menu is certainly one option. The downside there is discoverability, right? People, the idea behind the overflow menu is you never see it unless you really want to go looking through it. A better idea is just to go and put a, just so, you know, when users get to the part of the app where they try and get to the premium features is where you could start promoting the upgrade. So have the UI controls available, and then, you know, when you click on them, you could pop up a dialog saying this is reserved for a pro version. Or you could have an entirely separate screen with all the controls disabled and say, you know, click here to upgrade. I probably a better idea just to go and display the dialog as soon as they click on the button that takes you to that part of your app. Now, I still would have an option in the overflow menu to go and apply the upgrade for people who know that they really want to get to it to keep them from having to dig. But you know, definitely look at other opportunities for upselling, right? Try and figure out you know, how users will know that there's actually additional value, that is something they want to buy.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep.
Thanks for your question.
Anybody else? All right. We'll move on to the next question to moderator. Is that okay? Yeah.
Absolutely.
Producer says, okay. I'm loading several images from disk at basically the same time, using a background thread, of course. However, loading so many images in a matter of milliseconds will cause GC4 alloc, causing noticeable jank. Anything I can do about that?
This sounds like a performance question. Jeff, do you want to take a shot at this?
Sure. So something to realize is even in that background thread, if you're making that allocation, you're allocating those bitmaps, if you do end up having to do this GC4 alloc, it could potentially end up blocking the main thread of your application that's running the UI, the animation, if that main thread is also trying to allocate things. So really what you're looking to do here is you want to really optimize and minimize the number of allocations you're doing on that main thread. Because what you might find in this case is there's one small little allocation that's being exposed to this pause from the background thread. If you're able to get the UI animation done with zero allocations, if you get it all the way down to zero, you probably wouldn't see that pause that you're describing.
Yep. Also, I'll add that I did a code lab at Google I.O. that did something very similar to the behavior you're describing. And specifically, I created a grid view that loads a bunch of really high-resolution images over and over again. And we sort of walked people through going and finding all the hotspots in the code, all the things that would cause, you know, garbage collection, cause you know, just general jank, everything that was bad. And we'd go and get rid of them one after the other. And I think that you can get a link to it from the Google I.O. website. If not, it is on my own website, tjohns.net/io2012. I have all the code up there. Important things, make sure, you know, of course, for performance reasons, you're going to want to load your images in a background thread, use async task or something similar. Also, make sure that you're reusing all of your list view element, item views, I think is the word. Make sure you reuse those. They do get recycled, and just make sure that you reuse objects whenever possible. On that note, make sure that you're recycling bitmaps too, right? All the usual things for whenever you're dealing with bitmaps apply there, because they do take up a lot of memory, and it's very easy to mess up and cause objects to be created when they don't need to be. And we've added a lot of hooks there, especially, like I said, you can recycle bitmaps and, you know, hang on to things that way. Actually, I'm trying to recycling a bitmap, I think, gets rid of it, right? I'm trying to remember what the right way to do it is. Do either of you remember what the right way to handle bitmaps? Like, reuse the address space there for it?
I'm trying to remember. Because there is, like, a release method or a recycle.
Right.
But I don't think that's what...
Right, I think recycling actually completely gets rid of it.
Yeah, recycling gets rid of the address space completely. Or at least, yeah.
But there is a method where you can pass it in an existing instance into a bitmap options as part of the inflate. And that's one of the mechanism that you're describing that would allow you to recycle those existing allocations.
Right.
But yeah, the biggest takeaway, though, is avoid allocations inside of your drawing, your on draws, because that's what's probably exposing, in this case, to that jank.
Yep. And you can take a look in DDMS. There is an allocation tracker that will show you where all of your memory is going. And that should give you a pretty strong clue as to what's causing all of these GC events. All right.
Excellent. Okay. I actually have a question from someone on the invite.
Okay.
So Simon Marquis, who wants to know, what is the best choice to play a list of music files for an app and sometimes interrupts them to play an effect sound? And he's listed a couple of ideas. And also, what is the... you know, is there a best practice to properly handle the sound, like when the screen is off and so on and so forth? So I'm going to jump in and answer that as well. So, yes, SoundPool is the API that you want to look for to best handle that sort of thing. So, you know, a variety of different sound effects and music within within a game. SoundPool is definitely your friend. And the Media Player API, should you need it, but I think you should actually be able to handle most things within SoundPool by itself. In terms of the best way to handle sound playing, our good friends from the Friday Review, Ian Lewis and Dan Galpin, actually covered this in some detail at their Google I.O. talk, 10 Things All Game Developers Should Know. So check that out, and that'll give you some great advice, particularly how to handle things like music playback during the lock screen and when the screen's off and those sorts of things.
Great answer. Thank you. Thank you very much. Next question from Moderator. In the developer's console for one app, the content rating has the everyone rating disabled, and next to it, it says, this rating option has been disabled by the Google Play team. What could have caused this?
The answer is actually right there in front of your face. It was manually set by a member of the Google Play team. So we do periodically review apps, and if we notice that an app has an incorrect rating, it's rated lower than it should be, we'll go and make a manual adjustment, and that's what you're seeing there. So basically, they're saying your app contains some sort of content that it makes it unsuitable for everyone. And yeah.
In my experience, the most common cause for that is typically if you're using some sort of, if you're requesting find location in your app as a permission, then there is a minimum level, minimum maturity level, which it has to be. I think it's not the lowest, but possibly the next up from that at least. So that tends to be the most common case. It can also be if there is, you know, if your app's being flagged and the play team are looking through to make sure that it's compliant with our content policies and so on, they may do it manually for those reasons as well. But location, I think, is typically the most common case for this sort of thing.
That's good to know. Okay. Great. Next question from Moderator. When using an MHL adapter to get HDMI out, some apps like YouTube show different views on the device display and the HDMI output. How's that done? I could not find any API for this. Is it hardware dependent?
So I did some digging into this, and the answer is there isn't really an API. This is something that's done by the system. Whenever at least the Google Experience devices detect a video surface, they'll modify the HDMI output to go and display the contents of only that video surface. So it's not something that YouTube is explicitly doing. It's something that the system is taking care of automatically. Now, that said, this behavior is not guaranteed for all devices. It's a vendor-specific implementation detail. So other devices might choose to handle HDMI differently. But you know, to answer your question, though, if you want to go and display some custom content on the other display, there's not really a way to do it right now. It's just limited to videos.
Okay, thank you.
I have two questions from from the live invite. One is by, that's a name which is going to be hard for me, Tejaz Lagvanka, who would like to know the name of the guy in the hat.
My name is Trevor Johns. I'm actually on here almost every week, usually without a hat. But yeah, I'm on the same team as Joe and Rado. We're all members of the Android Developer Relations team. So, yeah.
we are sort of trying to implement possibly having a mandatory hat-wearing person in each of our sessions. That's usually Dan Galpin on Friday. But seeing as Dan doesn't sit in on these sessions, we thought we'd see if Trevor can sport a hat with the style to which we've become accustomed. The next question is from Nicholas Johnson, and he's attempting to develop a rich text component with buttons for typical rich text editing. And he goes on to say that spans are really difficult to work with, and the whole thing is kind of a pain, particularly when you get to things like text selection. So my suggestion here, and it'll be interesting to see if you guys agree, but attempting to develop a rich text editing component within Android is not going to be simple. You're effectively going to have to recreate the edit text component from scratch, because as soon as you're trying to do things like change colors, midline, add italics and bold and so on and so forth to arbitrary text within a full control, then you really need to also take care of how that layout is going to work. So you're effectively going to end up having to recreate the edit text component from scratch into something which, within a fairly short amount of time, is going to look a lot like a web browser, which is, in fact, how a lot of teams have implemented this sort of thing, so where they do have the need for rich text editing rather than being sort of a variation of the edit text. It's actually a web view within the app. So that, I don't know, my gut feeling is that that's kind of going to be the way to go if you want to have something like anything beyond sort of really simple markup. How do you guys feel?
Yeah, I think that pretty much covers it. Rich text is definitely something that's very difficult to implement. And WebView covers most of it already. It covers more than you probably want, so it gives you room for expansion. And honestly, most of the time when people are doing rich text anyway, they're going to go and want to convert it to HTML, so using a WebView takes care of that for you as well.
Okay, thank you. Next question from moderator. I've noticed that some apps that use action bar tabs for navigation will have the tabs replaced with the drop-down list when switched to landscape, when there isn't enough room for tabs. Is there a way to force it to do that? Landscape tags are ugly. Okay.
I think the simple answer for me is to try and use an action bar wherever possible, because that's going to already have that sort of toggle between a navigation in so it's going to be a drop down navigation in portrait mode and sort of in action bar tabs potentially in landscape mode, so you can sort of do that variation yourself. It doesn't necessarily help you if you want to have apps which work prior to Honeycomb, mind you, but you could certainly try and use that same sort of model. In general, my feeling is that your tab host control isn't great, but this is talking about action bar tabs in general. So yeah, okay, so it's specific to action bar tabs, so that would be my suggestion, is to just switch between them using the spinner in portrait and the tabs in landscape, or vice versa.
All right, thank you very much. Next question.
Got a hangout question.
Oh, shoot.
Excellent.
I created a test database and exported the strings to insert test data on looping through a string array, and while executing each command to populate the database. I couldn't use begin transaction because I was already in one. Any advice for creating a test database on a device?
So you were already in a transaction. So just to, I don't know if they're running this. So it's an Android program, it's an Android app, and they're attempting to build a pre-populated database? Is that's what it sounds like? So that you should be able to create everything inside of a single transaction on your own. I'm not sure what the exec... It shouldn't be creating a transaction on your behalf. You should be able to begin and manage your own. But, yeah, without any more detail. The other thing he was mentioning is that it's designed to be generated... one, so he's pre-generating a SQLite database to then ship?
We're getting some clarification.
Okay.
It was in the onCreate in the open helper.
Okay. You should be able to... so if it's in the onCreate, you're right. You may already be in a transaction at that point. So if you were looking to test performance, it should be as good as it's going to get. The one other thing to potentially look at is when you're doing that initial database setup and you're inserting a lot of data in a bulk way, you may look at creating your indexes after you've inserted all of the data. If you create the indexes and then do a whole bunch of inserts, the database is going to may try updating those indexes as you're inserting all of your data. But if you insert the data first and then create the indexes, you may end up with less work on the database engine side of things. So it may be faster.
Okay. Any response from him?
He said thanks.
Okay. Well, if you've got any more questions, yeah, just holler out. Otherwise, we'll move on to the next question and moderator. I have to load an image with certain restrictions. For example, I have an 8-megapixel picture that I want to center crop as a square, rotate, and maybe scale it. What's the most efficient way to do this without creating new bitmaps and recycling the old one?
All right, that's actually a pretty good question. Yeah, Jeff, you don't have an answer off the top of your head for that?
So I think it depends on if the user can zoom in on the photo while they're actually working on it. Because there are some, so the 8 megapixel, that's a lot of data behind the scenes. So there's a handful of bitmap factory, the bitmap options, you can actually request to have it downsampled. So you can request it to maybe only load every other pixel. So instead of an 8 megapixel photo, now you're working with a 4 megapixel. So there's some options there that you can load a lower resolution version of the photo for the user to edit. It may not be the full quality that they're expecting, and maybe lower resolution. Once you've decided the mutation operations that the user wants to perform, once they've chosen like the exact rotation, you can go back and perform a high quality pass of those operations on the full resolution photo. So that may allow you to make your UI nice and fast. You're maybe rotating and manipulating something lower quality, but then applying it later against the full resolution image.
That seems like it would be a fairly good approach for what they're describing here, because it's fairly coarse grained stuff. So center crop, square, rotate. So it sounds like they just basically want to be able to load up any picture, and in the same way that you choose like a profile pic or something in a social network, you just need it to be square. So you just pick it. I think in that instance, particularly on an Android app, even if you are zooming in, as long as it's sort of good enough to see what the edges are, you can do that and then do like a live preview of the cropped data at a higher res, maybe.
Bitmap Factory has methods to do most of that stuff. The only one I'm not clear about is rotation. I'm not sure if you can have it rotate for you. If that's the case, you might even want to consider subclassing Bitmap Factory and adding rotation in there, so that way all these operations are performed as you're loading the bitmap. And that would help reduce the if you can do it before you create your bitmap, then you only have to create one bitmap.
Yeah, the benefit of using those options is that Skia down deep in the native code is the one that's doing this downsampling. So your application doesn't have to allocate 8 megapixels worth of data to store the data to store the image when it's inflated. So it's doing it in a very optimized way under the hood.
Okay, thank you. Next question from moderator. Could you consider maintaining the Android and support library artifacts officially in Maven Central? Whoever does it now can be a bit slow, and it is a pain in the ass. Want of a better word?
So, yeah, feature request noted. We've always had a bit of reluctance to go and support any build systems aside from Eclipse, just because that's what we decided that we wanted to go and spend our time supporting, and we've always left everything else to the community to do. I'll definitely pass that along to the build team and the tools team rather, and let them know that there's a feature request for that. That being said, I'm pretty sure they've heard it before. It's not the first time I've seen this come up, but most likely it's going to be a bit of a tough sell because we have chosen to go and focus most of our efforts on Eclipse. But again, I'll make sure they get that feedback.
Related to that as well, I mean we sit right next to the tools team, so if you guys have like questions or requests or something like that, and you'd like to see us do a hangout or something like this specifically so you guys can talk to them, let us know, and we'll schedule something up. That is a resource available. We're not part of that team, so we aren't necessarily the best position to answer those sorts of questions.
All right. We're getting towards the end, so let's move on through as quickly as we can. Did the Nexus S have its offline voice dictation and hot word detection disabled in 4.1.1 due to inadequate audio hardware? If so, what are your guidelines for testing if devices for running 4.1 meet the baseline for using the relevant new multimedia APIs?
I don't think anybody here actually knows the answer to that, given that none of us work on the voice team. So this is probably a question better suited for another office hours. We might have somebody from the voice team on, but right now, we have no experts who can actually give you a definitive answer there.
You got a hangout question?
Go for it.
It's about location updates in a service.
Right.
Is it better battery-wise to sample updates from network or passive providers on an interval, or register on start a listener or pending intent and depend on the request updates parameters for min time and min distance?
Okay. So let me see if I understand this. So the question is, are they better off polling? So basically getting a get last known location or using a... we're basically asking for location-based updates at a minimum time and distance. Is that the gist?
Yeah, it sounds about right.
Sounds about right.
Yeah, so from what I remember, get last position is literally returning the last known position, which is not going to be where the user is at that necessarily at that given moment. So that is one issue you have to deal with.
Yeah, I would say, in terms of efficiency, so in terms of efficiency, I would almost never recommend a polling approach. As soon as you're polling for anything, then you're creating a minimum amount of time where the device is going to be on, responding to whatever it is that you're doing at that wake up. So if you can have anything which is more on demand, that tends to be a better solution. So I would definitely go with actually creating a location listener, particularly for passive provider. That way, if there are no apps requesting location updates, then your app will never get triggered, so it will go to sleep. And so this is really important when the device is on standby. So if you are doing a polling solution, then you're still going to wake the device and you're still going to check to see what that last location update was, even if it hasn't changed for an hour. Whereas if you've actually got a listener registered, it's no less efficient than polling in terms of the work it's doing, and you have the advantage of being on demand so that it's only going to happen as frequently as any other app is actually making those location requests.
Okay, thank you. This is an interesting one. Can you take another look at my question from last week? Ran out of time at the end. Question is, how to iterate through fragments in a tabbed view pager to tell each fragment the paint data which has been updated by a loader in the main activity?
I remember hearing that question last week while I was doing the production. I don't think we had a great answer then, and I'm not sure that there really is one.
Yeah, well, I still... My question is, why are you trying to do this, given that you're only going to have one page on your view pager visible, and trying to ask anything else to update while it's in the background is just a waste of CPU. Most UI events don't occur for objects which are off-screen. Now, that being said, the answer here is basically your typical solution for communicating with fragments. I don't think ViewPager really has anything to do with it. It's really a matter of just going and sending a method to all of your fragments. So register some sort of callback method so that your activity can just go and deliver a message to all of the known fragments when these events happen and let them know that they have stale data which needs to be refreshed at some point which is appropriate.
And that's kind of... So Data Set Observer is one way that list views, for example, connect up to cursors. So when you assign a cursor to a cursor loader and it's bound to a list view, that list view may be often one of those other fragments, but the Data Set Observer is the mechanism by which it knows I need to invalidate and repaint my content. So a strategy like that, there's Data Set Observer and Data Set Observable. Those may be a good strategy.
Okay.
We got another hangout question in 2 more minutes.
All right. Hangout question.
Yeah, last one here. This person has quite a big database of assets and dumps it into an SD card. Is there a way to access this database directly to assets so I don't have to duplicate it since it's like 6 megabytes? Does that make sense?
Yeah, so I think what he wants to do here is basically... similar to the question which one of the earlier questioners had, which is I want to pre-populate a database, but I don't want to download it piecemeal. I just want to be able to dump it on an SD card, possibly as part of the installation process or as a one-off. And right now you would have to, the usual way is that you would then have to open that database, move everything into an SQLite database, and have the content provider on top of that to do most operations. So I think the question here is there a way you can just point to that database and say, this is my database, treat it the same way you would an SQLite database that you had opened. So I'm not sure that I have an answer. I think if it is an SQLite database, then you probably can. If it's not, then I'm not sure that that's possible. Do you guys have any
So SQLite databases, I think you can open based on an explicit file system path. Yeah. You can tell it open this file. But one thing to note is that if it's living out on the SD card, anyone could come along, open it, writable, and write any sort of data in there, which then your app is going to go consume. So anything on the SD card is publicly available for other apps to write into. The other thing is, if you're using it for persistence, just be aware that sometimes the SD card can disappear, but it may also not be, the SD card can be of varying quality, because they're using a different file system that's maybe not as resilient. If you're using the internal file system on the device, maybe it's like YAFS or EXT4, it's a lot more resilient to like changes if the user pulls the battery out of their device.
Yeah, I think that I really just want to emphasize that that first point, which is that it's trivially easy for your SD card to be, or your shared space to be unmounted. And if someone plugs it into their computer, boom, your database disappears. If they unclick their SD card, boom, your database is gone. And so that adds a certain amount of, how can I say, doesn't do bad things, it doesn't do good things to your app, so that suddenly you have to keep in mind the fact that your database may just disappear mid-transaction and figure out how you're going to recover from that. And as well, as Jeff said, it can change, so it can be mounted to a computer, then have all of its data changed, and then plugged back in, and you need to figure out what you're going to do with that now. So it's generally not great practice to go that way. And granted, if you've got a very large database, it seems like a reasonable alternative, but you may actually want to consider storing, keeping most of that on a server, and just downloading effectively enough data to have cached a reasonable amount of data to be able to respond to when you're offline, rather than storing the entire thing on the phone. Depending on your usage model, that may not work.
Okay. So I think that's it for time.
I think we have run off the end of the clock. So, once again, thank you everybody for stopping in, and we will see you next week.
Thanks, everyone.